And we will turn to City of Boulder against Farmers Reservoir and Irrigation Company. Strickelt.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am John P. Acolt, appearing on behalf of the Farmers Reservoir and Irrigation Company. I'm pleased to have with me my son and partner, John C. Acolt, who also practices with me and is also appearing on behalf of the Farmers Company. As reflected in the record, the Farmers Company is a mutual ditch company. We operate four reservoirs, approximately 400 miles of canals. We're scattered across 3,500 square miles from Denver to Greeley, and we provide a municipal water supply to about 250,000 people in the Northwest metro area, an irrigation supply for about 60,000 acres. So we are in the area where the principles that are presented in this case are exceedingly important to us.
Counsel, it's not probably pertinent to the case, but I was just curious, this ditch water comes from where? Is this a Boulder Creek? Or?
In this case, the community canal diverts from South Boulder Creek at El Dorado Springs and runs northeasterly or southeasterly approximately 6 miles to Marshall Lake. And from Marshall Lake, it's distributed to the city of Louisville and to other.
Thank you.
We have other ditches and reservoirs in other basins as well. But the four principles, four issues that are presented in this case. The application of Section 4.8 of the Restatement as adopted by the Roaring Fork case in the Supreme Court. The binding effect of the agreement that was reached with the CDOT predecessor in 1953 with regard to the construction of the box culvert over the community canal. The recognition of the right to protect the water quality in the canal that we deliver to both our farmers and to our municipal customers. And specific to this case, using standard prescriptive easement standards, a portion of the footprint of our dam extends past our deeded property description, and a portion of our high water line extends past our deeded description, and we believe we presented in this case the grounds for recognizing the prescriptive easement for those two pieces of the Marshall Lake system that extend beyond the deeded boundaries that the court found in our favor on. Now, with respect to these issues, three have transcendent principles that extend beyond the circumstances of this case. This case is important to us, but the principles that are involved in Roaring Fork, the binding effect of the agreement with CDOT, and the recognition of our right to protect water quality transcend this particular case and apply generally not only to our operations, but the operations of every ditch company in Colorado. Specific to this case, the question is, is Roaring Fork, the principles of Roaring Fork, Section 4.8 of the Restatement, applicable to the facts that were presented? As the record reflects, the case was presented on the basis that CDOT was the owner of the underlying fee under the box culvert on Highway 93, where our canal goes under the highway.
Mr. Acolt, if I remember this right, I think the complaint alleged CDOT was the owner, and you all admitted that. Correct?
No, we did not admit. We challenged that.
You not admit it in your answer?
We did not.
You may want to check that.
I don't believe we did, and it was tried, and it was found in our favor.
Okay.
And CDOT, Franco had an earlier easement dating from the early 1900s. CDOT acquired an interest in this location when Highway 93 was reconstructed in 1953 from a landowner, and Boulder purchased the land for the open space that goes to the described highway right-of-way, as far as the deeds in this case are concerned. It was tried on the basis that CDOT was the owner and Boulder was a licensee of CDOT. As it turns out, the court found that CDOT owned only an easement, that the terms of their deed did not extend to a fee interest. So specific to this case, in this appeal, CDOT and Boulder are not the underlying fee owners. And the argument that Boulder then made was, well, an easement owner can invoke Roaring Fork just like an underlying fee owner.
Well, let me ask you, back up a minute, Mr. Acolt. Let's say for argument's sake that CDOT were the owner.
Yes.
And Boulder is a licensee.
Yes.
Why would not, I recognize Roaring Fork deals with the owner of the serving estate and the benefited estate. Why wouldn't, or the dominant estate, why wouldn't that apply to a licensee of the serving estate owner?
It could, but the terms of the question is, can a licensee enforce the provision or the rights of a fee owner when the fee owner was not asserting the rights, is what is in this case.
Well, but in this case, and correct me if this is wrong, I think CDOT entered into this license agreement or license contract with Boulder.
Yes.
And that agreement specifically said Boulder needs to go get the approval and take whatever action is necessary.
That's right.
And then Boulder brought the suit.
No, well, Boulder sought the approval from us. We denied it.
And then brought the deck action.
And then brought the deck action.
So why isn't Boulder proceeding? And I think there was testimony, as I recall, that that CDOT author said, I authorized Boulder to go ahead and bring the suit. Why doesn't that get you enough for Roaring Fork?
CDOT did not authorize the bringing of the suit. Frankly, we don't think that that's material to the issue that has to be decided. What we're simply saying is neither CDOT nor Boulder are the underlying owner. That's a fact in this case. More importantly, the fact in this case is in 1953, the exhibit number 50, which was the document that asked FRICO and CDOT asked FRICO in the reconstruction of the highway to review the plans, to agree to the relocation of the canal, to sign the plans, and to return them to CDOT. And they attached their transmittal letter to that, calling it the canal agreements. FRICO did that. It reviewed the plans. The plans were a box culvert, 14 feet wide, 10 feet high. We agreed to the relocation of our canal. We agreed to the operation of the system with that configuration. Now, that becomes important for two ways. We'll argue in a moment that that creates a contract. It also is important for the application of Roaring Fork. And Roaring Fork and the Section 4.8 say that if the specifications and the location and the structure of the easement are fixed, it cannot be modified under Roaring Fork. Even absent being an enforceable contract agreement, there was agreement as to the location, the structure, the size, and most particularly, that the canal culvert was to be a free span, that is, no pylons, no pillars in our canal, because, as the record reflects, they collect ice, they collect trash, and they make it impossible to adequately maintain the ditch. They interfere with our operation. This structure has 22 pylons going through that box culvert. Since 1953, the record reflects, we haven't accepted a single bridge structure that has even one center pillar. It's an anachronistic design that we haven't approved, and that's why we didn't approve it in this case. So the question about the agreement with CDOT is twofold. Is it a binding agreement, or is it at least agreement as to location, structure, and dimension with CDOT that cannot then be modified by Roaring Fork?
Would you agree, Mr. Acolt, that our standard of review on that question is clearly erroneous, that the existence of a contract is a fact question?
No, well, the question is the interpretation of the documents, not whether the documents exist.
Well, the district court here found, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the district court found there this 1953 document was not a contract.
He found what the facts were, and then he said that doesn't constitute a contract. On that basis, we believe it's a matter of law.
Okay.
The facts aren't in dispute. The question is, what do you do with the facts? But the transcendent issue here on Roaring Fork, just to go back to Roaring Fork specifically, it's very clear what the three-prong test of Roaring Fork is. It's whether or not there's significant lessening of the utility of the easement, increasing the burden of the on the owner of the easement, or frustration of the purpose. That's the three-prong test. Page 6 of the court's findings says that he looked at water quantity, water quality, timing of delivery, and maintenance. That's the wrong test. So if nothing else in this case, site-specific to this, the facts of this case, it's clear the judge applied the wrong standard. Now, Boulder argues the right standard in their case. We believe we argued the right standard. The only one that didn't apply the right three-prong test is the trial court.
And for you, the issue is maintenance more than anything else, is that right?
Maintenance is the main issue.
All right, and I couldn't, I confess, I couldn't find a case that describes or defines what maintenance rights means.
Well, maintenance, among other things, in this particular case is, this is on a curve, and berms build up on the inside corners of curves. We send in our equipment, a little, we call them skid steers or bobcats or bulldozers, to go through the culvert, push the materials back to where a backhoe can pick them up and take it out of the canal. That's the primary maintenance that is interfered with here. We have a situation where we come in from the upper end, a couple miles at a mile an hour. We put the bobcat into the canal, push the silt to that, and it takes it out. If we cannot go through that box culvert, we have to load the equipment up, go back upstream, load the equipment up, go clear back down to Marshall Lake, come back in 4 miles from the other side and do the same thing. It is an enormous problem, enormous interference with our operation.
So you would define maintenance rights as your ability to maintain?
Yes.
Because, I mean, it strikes me as odd to use the phrase maintenance rights as opposed to obligation.
Trash, ice, materials, berms, tree limbs, whatever collects in the canal, of which a lot does.
Now, how do you respond to Boulder's argument? I understand what you just said about having to pull out all the equipment and coming in from the other side. I guess they said at trial, that's how you did it before. So there's been no impact
on
you.
It's not how we did it before.
Okay.
We sent the facts are we sent the bobcat or the bulldozer through the culvert to get to the other side and push it back to where the excavator could pick it up on the upside.
Okay, so you actually, you talked about at the trial or put on evidence about the difference between major maintenance and kind of annual maintenance. So there was actually annual maintenance done where you pushed all the way through?
Not necessarily every year, but when it was done, it was important.
Okay.
Every year we have maintenance on that canal. Every year we have to get trash out. Every year, if there's 22 pylons, we will have to have somebody in there picking the trash out.
But as a factual matter, it had been done that way.
Yes.
Okay.
Undisputed.
Thank you.
So the main question and the transcendent question is, Boulder argued, and I believe that the Boulder District Court accepted, that Roaring Fork is a general standard of accommodation. That is, there are not specific limitations on the application. It accommodates the needs of the underlying landowner and the needs and desires of the easement holder. And we believe that is absolutely false as a legal principle. The court was very specific in the supplemental case of Tonko v. Mullum, and it addressed whether or not Roaring Fork is a general standard of accommodation, and it says it is not. Specifically, Mallow, which we cited in our brief at page 22, says, if the maintenance rights of the owner of the ditch easement are adversely affected by the change of the easement, then such change does not comport with the legal requirements. That's it. That is, in fact, the determination of whether a modification can be made under Roaring Fork. You don't have a general accommodation. You don't have a general balancing of equities. You have a question of, is the owner's right to maintain and operate its ditch interfered with?
If the answer interference of even the slightest degree, that's a deal breaker.
Well, obviously, Your Honor, you're asking a continuum question where there obviously is something where something is immaterial and therefore could be disregarded. But absent immateriality, any material interference takes you out of Roaring Fork. And to the extent that it's material, it's very material here. So that is the transcendent issue. The transcendent issue is where you have interference with the operation of a ditch. As a legal principle, Roaring Fork does not apply. That is what we believe the appropriate application of Roaring Fork is. Let's address the 1953 agreement with CDOT. As I mentioned, it provided for the moving of our canal, the granting of an easement from Franco to CDOT to build the box culvert. That's Exhibit 50. The structure and dimension of the box culvert and the specific statement that it was to be a free span. Now, in this context, what that means is that if that can be unilaterally changed, Franco has 400 miles of canals and thousands, literally thousands of crossings. We have streets, we have roads, we have utility lines, we have electric lines, we have gas lines. Every one of them has some kind of standard. 4 feet below the invert of the canal, 10 feet from the bank, 14 feet above the road, if in fact it's an above road line. If the parties to those agreements where we sign off on specifications can subsequently change those at will, we're out of business. If they change the depth of a pipeline or they change a structure from a no span to a single pillar at will, then there is no ability of us to maintain control over our destiny. And believe me, in the 3,500 square miles in the Front Range, there is not a subdivision out there that doesn't want to modify or cross or do something with one or more of our canals on a daily basis. We have to have the permanency, so long as the structure is there, of what we approve in the standards that we approve. And that is what is in this case. And as I mentioned, even if it is not a binding contract, which we believe clearly it is, it still stands for a definition of the easement and location and dimensions of the easement under Roaring Fork, and Section 4.8 does not apply to that. I'm nearly out of time. I recognize that. The third and most other main piece to address is water quality. We urge the court not to accept the standard that the court applied, which is we have to suffer a major or show a major calamity to our municipal customers. Like in Milwaukee, where 50 people died and 100,000.
I need to interrupt you, but your time is up.
Yes. We need to have the ability to address the water quality in our canals. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. O'Brien.
Good afternoon. My name is Erin O'Brien, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Boulder. The restatement is the law in Colorado only so far as Colorado courts adopt it. Section 4.8 of the restatement sets forth an accommodation principle which allows a servient owner to change an easement unless denied by the terms of the easement. The restatement applies to easements generally, all easements, such as utility easements, transportation easements, or private access easements. The three factors set out in the restatement to be looked at by a court are whether or not the proposed change or after the fact change would lessen the utility of the easement, would increase the burdens on the easement owner, or frustrate the purpose for which the easement was created. Roaring Fork is the Colorado case that adopts the accommodation principle of the restatement. Whereas the restatement covers all easements generally, the Roaring Fork case applies the accommodation principle to ditch easements specifically. Obviously, moving water in an open channel is different from moving electrical current in a wire or moving motor vehicles on a roadway. For that reason, the Roaring Fork case specifies four factors specific to ditch easements to consider when determining whether or not a proposed change is reasonable or not. The additional requirements of the Roaring Fork case are looking at the water quality, water quantity, timing of the water, and ditch maintenance. Now, the holding of the Roaring Fork gave a servient owner two ways in which to change an easement, one by permission of the easement owner, or two by going to court for a declaratory judgment. What Roaring Fork did not do was expressly adopt the requirement that only those easements can be modified unless otherwise prohibited by the terms of the easement. Such language would be easy enough for the Roaring Fork court to adopt, but they did not. I think partially that reason is whereas the restatement may come after the fact in determining whether or not a trespass has occurred, the process set out by the Roaring Fork opinion is proactive. So that an owner comes to court and asks permission to make the change versus coming in later and defending a trespass action.
Ms. O'Brien, would you address Mr. Acolt's argument that Roaring Fork does not apply at all because the plaintiff here was not the servient owner?
I don't agree with Mr. Acolt. In this location in question, there are three potential owners. There's FRICO, there's the City of Boulder, and there's CDOT. The court clearly found that FRICO owns an easement. That leaves either Boulder or CDOT is owning the underlying fee. The court did note in footnote one that ultimately it doesn't matter. Either Boulder or CDOT owns the fee. Both of us own something, both of which are servient to FRICO's easement. So whether or not we own a fee, whether or not we own an easement, whether or not CDOT owns the fee or CDOT owns merely a right-of-way, whatever the ownership interest is, it's servient to FRICO.
So your position is either CDOT or Boulder is the servient estate owner for Roaring Fork purposes?
Correct, and most likely both.
Okay. And then let's assume, for argument's sake, that CDOT, am I wrong? Did you not allege in your complaint that CDOT owned the land under the culvert?
I believe we did.
Okay. Let's assume, for hypothetical purposes, that CDOT owns the land and Boulder had, and it was just a licensee. Mm-hmm. Is it your position that Boulder as licensee could bring the Dick Deck action under Roaring Fork?
That's correct. The deeds in this area are very old, and that was precisely the reason why we did bring in CDOT and we did seek the license, because we were not absolutely sure who the fee owner was, though we did allege that it was CDOT.
Okay. Thank you.
In the Roaring Fork opinion, the trial court sets out in footnote 3 what sort of procedure a trial court would follow when determining whether or not a change could be made to an easement. The requirement there is that the servient owner must show a prima facie case showing that there is no damage by the proposed alteration, and then the burden shifts to the easement owner to show damage.
Counsel, at that point, I'd like you just to address, why isn't it obvious that there is some detrimental impact on the ditch company's ability to maintain this, I don't know, whatever you call it, this culvert, this passageway?
Extensive findings of fact and testimony was taken at trial. FICO's own engineer testified about a letter that he had written that said that this proposed underpass could be built in accordance with ditch operations.
But wasn't he, that letter focused on operation, on hydrology? He really didn't address maintenance anywhere in that letter, did he?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I apologize.
I think maintenance, a lot of time was spent at trial on maintenance, and the difference was made between annual maintenance and less than annual maintenance. And what I believe the testimony was that the maintenance that FICO speaks of, where the equipment needs to pass through the culvert, occurs approximately once every 10 years.
So, but once every 10 years, this is a big deal.
I wouldn't concede that it is a big deal. I think there are other ways to perform that maintenance, that either the equipment can go around the culvert up over the highway, as our hikers currently do, or that the Bobcat can be loaded up and transported to the location and then offloaded and maintenance performed.
But the testimony was, and I think it was undisputed from FICO's people, that would cost them an extra day. I don't think Boulder put on anything to contradict that.
No, and I would say that an extra day is not damage.
Okay.
Given the frequency that it would need to occur.
Yeah, and one other question on this maintenance, well, I guess two questions. Would you, when we're talking about maintenance rights for Roaring Fork purposes, do you agree that we're talking about the right thing? It's the ability to maintain. That's what that means.
We're
yes. looking at impact. Okay. And so, as I at least understand the record or understood it, Boulder put on an expert who testified the impact would be de minimis. Boulder could do all this stuff. And FRICO's response was, well, that's nice, they could do it. We don't have that equipment. Am I remembering the testimony right?
That's correct. I believe that's Bob Profasi's testimony.
Okay.
Ms. O'Brien, along the same lines, what authority is there in Roaring Fork or any other case for this kind of equitable remedy the court fashioned of requiring Boulder to undertake the maintenance obligation?
The Roaring Fork opinion spends a great, you know, some amount of time looking at trespass, in that there have historically been rewards for trespass in Colorado law. In some cases, the servient estate owner went out, changed the easement, and that was allowed to stand. In one case in particular, Brown v. Bradbury, which I believe was a 1943 case, a fee owner moved a ditch that was close to his house because he had a young child. When that case went to court, the trial court allowed the alteration to remain and also shifted easement, maintenance of the easement from the easement owner to the servient estate owner. So I believe there is a line of cases where this was allowed, that maintenance was routinely shifted. And I think moving forward, still looking at self-help and trespass, that it makes sense that in a declaratory action, a servient estate owner ought to be able to get the same sort of remedy that he would by trespass. Otherwise, there's still an incentive for trespass. So I think it's based on prior cases and the intent of Roaring Fork to not reward trespass.
But here, we're not dealing with a trespass.
Correct.
Okay, so why don't those considerations just go out the window here? I mean, you've got an entity that says, it's nice that Boulder would do that, but we have to be concerned about our own liability. We have to make sure it's done right, because if something happens, whoever's hurt's going to come back against us. Why shouldn't that override Boulder's stated desire to take over the maintenance?
Well, I think that the burden shifting on maintenance doesn't take away Franco's right. Franco still has the ability and right to access the ditch, and the ability and right to get in there and perform maintenance if they choose. The fact that we may be primarily responsible for doing that doesn't mean that Franco isn't able to get in there and do it as they always have been.
But they can't, because they can't get their bobcat through.
They can do it, they just can't do it the same way that they always have.
So why isn't that then a burden on their ability to maintain? And as Mr. Acolt says, I mean, it's a quote in Tonko and in Roaring Fork, that if there's a burden, I'm not quoting it now, but if there's a burden, we're not under the restatement.
I would argue that one day every 10 years or an extra day every 10 years is not a burden.
So you would say, and really responding to what Judge Russell asked Mr. Acolt, there's a de minimis standard here. And your argument is that this would be a de minimis effect?
That's correct.
Or that this is something that the court can take into account in balancing the equities and fashioning the appropriate remedies so that everybody can move forward. My
yes.
question then is, why is the court's solution here adequate? Wouldn't it be necessary for the court to order that Boulder would be held harmless for any Boulder would have to hold the ditch company harmless for any lawsuits that would arise out of the failure to maintain this this passageway?
No, I don't think Boulder should be held harmless for failure to maintain. I think once that burden shifts, we have the responsibility to do it. It doesn't mean that Franco still isn't in the area and can't perform their own maintenance if they think we're doing it improperly.
But they can get sued. I mean, there are statutory obligations on Franco to maintain the ditch, and clear case law says they can be sued in negligence if they don't. And so without any kind of hold harmless or indemnity, there's one more burden on Franco, because someone can sue them.
Well, I would say someone can always sue someone.
Right.
Yeah, and if a suit was brought against Franco, then I would expect that we would very quickly be brought into that suit.
But then again, that's an added burden on them. If they're able to maintain their own ditch, and if they mess it up and get sued, then it's their problem. God bless them. They were negligent.
While it might be a burden, I wouldn't say that it's a maintenance burden. I think litigation is always a burden. I would note that Franco has conceded, though, that it is not damaged by the proposed underpass in areas of water quantity, water quality, or timing, that this is strictly limited to maintenance. Extensive testimony was taken at the trial court about maintenance, what is required, what would be required in the future, and I would also argue that those factual findings are entitled to their deference. Thank you.
Thank you. This case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.